You know, yesterday on the program, we spoke to David Parkin, the premiership-winning coach and player with Hawthorn and Carlton in the AFL. Today, we'll have a look at rugby league. Splendid new book called Rugby League Through the Decades is out now. The authors are Alan Whittaker and Ian Collis. We welcome them to Overnights. Very good morning.
Rod, how are you?
I'm nervous, if you don't mind me saying, because I really want Manly to win. Do you guys really want Manly to win?
Not really, no.
Oh, come on.
No, having married a Manly supporter, I'm sort of half in there. I'm half pregnant, but no, I can't see myself barracking for Manly, but it's going to be a great match either way.
Do you have to actually take sides in a grand final if your team isn't playing?
I think you have to. I mean, I think personally, I'm an old Tigers supporter. When we beat St George in the semi, that would have been very hard to take if we would have lost. The next week we lost to the Warriors. It didn't feel so bad because there wasn't that tradition in prior matches. So maybe that's part of the sentiment why people are against Manly, because they've been beaten by Manly in big games where the Warriors are a relatively new side and probably people would like to see them get a breakthrough premiership.
Yeah. Can we go all the way back to the start? Rugby league began really in Australia in 1908, although I think games had been played prior to that, hadn't they?
There were three games in 1907.
Right.
An all goals New Zealand composite team came over and played a representative bunch of league players called New South Wales at the time, and that kicked off the game.
They played rugby union rules, didn't they? Because they didn't know the rules.
That's what I was going to ask.
They didn't know the league rules.
They didn't have a rule book.
Yeah, league had been going in England since 1895. Mm-hmm. How different was it to rugby union in say, 1908 in Sydney? If people were watching league or watching union, could they tell the difference?
Well, we write in the book that an Englishman called McCabe came out and actually taught the clubs how to play the 13-man game, because it was different. You know, you had to play the ball, the scrummaging was different, there was no line-outs. And the incredible thing is, you know, within 12 months, Sydney crowds had adopted it, started off very modestly, 2,000 and 3,000. But within 2 or 3 years, they were drawing 20,000, 30,000 to the games. And people did jump on board what was a faster and a more exciting game.
I think also then, to like any new sport, you might have an initial impetus to get some interest and people get involved. Then there could have been signs that it was going to fall back, but then a lot of McKibbitt's team from 1908, 1909, that won the Olympic Games, came across and defected to league. And again, you got an enormous influx of quality players that gave the game the boost it needed.
That's what happened. It wasn't like all of a sudden a new game began and a whole lot of new players. The strength of league in 1908 over union, which it's held basically ever since, was that all those great players actually just switched and started playing league.
I think off the back of that too, during World War One, the union decided not to play their competitions, where the league kept going, and that gave them enormous impetus again to keep going.
Right. So that's within 6 or 7 years of the start of it. All of a sudden, as a war effort, the rugby union decided to suspend club matches. Mm-hmm. League kept going. Why did they do it, Alan?
Well, I think at that time, it was also an important source of income for many young players. Certainly, there weren't the riches there that are there now. But, you know, you could pick up a bonus of a couple of pounds at the end of the year. Right. Even the struggling clubs, Annandale and Glebe, you know, they paid their players' bonuses. And the whole idea about the breakaway, of course, is that players were going to be compensated for time lost from work. And this did lure a whole generation of players over to the professional game.
But what about the fact that young players should have been signing up to go to the war? How did they actually manage to keep the competition going in the war years?
Well, they did. I mean, there were still players that could play. They thought that it was important also from a social aspect to
maintain something at home.
To maintain a level of normality. Yeah. And they did that also during World War II.
Yes, in fact, you point that out in the book, that they were encouraged to do it by then.
And there was criticism by playing the game, because in the scheme of things, when you're fighting a war, it's extremely trivial.
But, was it controversial at the time, though, the decision?
No, I think they had the public support behind them because people wanted some distraction. You know, the media coverage at that time, you know, you learn about Gallipoli 3 weeks after the fact. And I think people needed that diversion. And because the clubs were great community assets, they were rooted in your local community and very insular to Sydney, inner Sydney clubs, that it was expected that, you know, you'd have this the winter sport. And it quickly overtook rugby union when rugby union came back after the war, but it overtook them as the major winter sport in Sydney.
When was the first golden age of rugby league? When was the first time that really, all of a sudden, you had a whole lot of great players playing and they were playing to the best of their ability, do you think?
I don't know if there was an early golden age.
Okay.
I think there was great teams and there was great players that always shone above the rest. The Messengers, into the 20s, the Treweeks, the Blairs for South, right. The 30s, you get Dave Brown and these sort of players. I think a golden age... One of the great golden ages was the 60s.
Right.
Now you can say, well, gee, that's a long time to have your first golden age. But yeah. I think that was such a powerful era and so many things happened. There were so many great players. That's not to say there wasn't great players and great teams earlier. But the 60s was one of the great golden ages, I think, of the game.
We struggled internationally in the 20s and 30s. The Lions had come out and belt us every 4 years. I think after the war, into the 50s, when we won the Ashes in 1950 under Clive Churchill, players started to realise that this was a viable profession. It became much more professional, much better run. And then with the advent of leagues clubs in the 1950s, clubs were really able to build up their assets. And by that time, they had 50 years of tribal following and mascots were very well known, the Rabbitohs, the Dragons. And I agree with Ian. By the time the 60s came around, the advent of television, the game had really galvanised as an important part of society in Sydney.
People today would find it astonishing that Australia did not beat England in a Test series for 30 years, from 1920 onwards. It's unbelievable, wasn't it?
Well, you could argue they beat them in 29-30 on the Kangaroos Tour.
It was a highly controversial no-try incident.
They really won that game. The game was taken off them. They went to a fourth Test. Extremely controversial. But you're right, it's an amazing span not to win an Ashes series against an opponent. We got close a lot of times, but we... A lot of controversial games. We never quite got there.
I think in that period where from 1920 to 1950 when we didn't win the Ashes, you had the war years as well and a whole generation of great players. I remember Frank Hyde telling us that many of those players were geared for international careers, but of course the war, Second World War, diverted that whole generation of players away from international rugby league and many of them, ultimately lost their lives in the war. And then it took us probably another 3 or 4 years to build up again. But by the time the 50s rolled around, we were very competitive and I think many old-timers would still say winning the Ashes in 1950 under Clive Churchill was the turning point in Australian rugby league. We were now on that equal footing.
It's interesting too, that 1950 third Test where we won, Clive Churchill was captain and seen as the man that really got us across the line, and Clive Churchill today is seen as the greatest player of all time. So we probably took the greatest player of all time to get that breakthrough win, just that little bit of brilliance that sometimes one individual can do it to transcend across the team.
Ian Collis and Alan Whittaker are my guests. We're talking about Rugby League Through the Decades, which is an incredible book, the most spectacularly beautiful and profusely illustrated rugby league book you will ever see. You talk about that golden age in the 50s and into the 60s, and yet, for those who know the rugby league and beyond that, only one team won it. Between 1956 and 66, 11 years in a row, St George won the competition every year. How did they do it, Ian?
But what a team.
It was a great side, I don't dispute that, but any little slip along those 11 years and the sequence is broken, and since then they've been nowhere near as successful. They've only won two premierships, really, since 1966. How did they do it?
Well, history says they had the best players. History says they had the smartest coach to kick them off.
Yeah.
Even though Ken Carney wasn't the coach in 1956, Norm Tipping was. He was the man, the leader on the field when he came and coached them in 1957 through to 61. He got them fitter than any other team. They were being coached to a level that other teams weren't being coached at, plus they had the best players.
And they had a very canny administration at St George with Frank Facer. They were able to secure players just when they were coming into their own. They grabbed Johnny Raper from Newtown when he was a teenager. They grabbed Popper Clay from Newtown. They were able to bring down the best players from Queensland, Elton Rasmussen, the best international players, Robin Gurley from Ireland. And they had probably, three grades of first-grade strength players to draw upon. But the players wanted to play for St George, and the domination wasn't seen as a bad thing. It was a good thing.
Alan makes a really good point there. They reinvented themselves. The common theme of Wayne Bennett, probably not seen as a great tactical coach, but he knew when to reinvent his team. He made a massive call to get rid of Wally Lewis, and Wally was still a great player. And St George were always looking ahead to reinvent themselves to keep them at that level.
Johnny Raper's a classic example. He could have played first grade at any other club, really, once St George got rid of him, but he chose to go off to Newcastle and play for 5 years.
Well, I think by the end of the 60s, John had played a lot of rugby league, and I think he probably got the tap on the shoulder from St George that, you know, another big contract wasn't in the wings. And you have to remember, too, especially in the 60s, not so much in the 70s, but you could earn a very good quid by going to a country centre and being a captain coach. Yes. You were often, you know, the marquee player for country centres. And Newcastle, of course, had a very viable competition in the 70s. They'd get 10 or 12,000 people to three or four grounds on the weekend. So going to the bush wasn't seen as a backward step for a lot of these players.
With a player of Johnny Raper's ilk, he was always seen as one of the premium players. And to go to Newcastle, he kept at that level,
right,
even though he might have been a little bit past his best. I mean, we all have egos, and obviously John wanted to be the man, and he was the man up there.
I think it must come from one of your collections of programs, and we've in fact spoken in the program before about your incredible collection of them. You've got one from, I think, was it the 60s? Clive Churchill's last match was not for a Sydney club. It was for Moree against Narrabri. It's incredible that, again, that shows again. He was the biggest name, the greatest player in the history of league, some would say, you would argue, and yet he's finishing his career playing for Moree.
Yeah, actually, in recent times, vision of that game has turned up. It's in colour, and it goes for about 15 minutes. It's amazing to see him running around in this white jersey. From Moree. It's spectacular.
And you have to remember, it's a professional sport, and if the dollar's there, players will go. But also, I think reading about Clive Churchill, you know, he was keen to put something back into the bush and keen to use his name to promote the game. He went to Queensland, of course, and inspired the Queenslanders to beat New South Wales in 59, and it wasn't the done thing. And I think he was very, very keen to back himself and to not just chase the dollar, but to see himself as, you know, the premier player of his era, which he was.
Right. Ian Collis, Alan Whittaker are our guests, and Rugby League Through the Decades is the book. TV really came into its own in the late 60s. I think the first grand final to be televised live was 1967, which was the first year after St George had their 11 straight premierships. And that was the first year of the four-tackle rule. They changed the rules. Ian, was that the biggest change in the history of the game, do you think?
I think so.
Way it's played on the field?
I think so. In 1966 especially, there were sides like Balmain that had goal kickers of the ilk of Keith Barnes. You then had Bobby Lanigan. These guys could kick goals from anywhere. So what sides were doing was hanging onto the ball, waiting for the penalty, and then kicking the goal.
So it's becoming like rugby union today.
It was becoming very boring. It was very boring football. And the administration, through England, had made the initial step to go to the four-tackle rule. It was a trial, and we took it up as well through Bill Buckley. And we trialled it, and it was a success. And then a couple of years later, they thought, well, let's go to six tackles. Four tackles, basically the first tackle, you're getting caught. The last tackle, you might be kicking it. So you had two tackles to play with it. Mm. It just wasn't enough.
And, of course, TV made a big contribution to revolutionising the game, because rugby league was now in the people's homes. I remember as a kid, Channel 9 and Channel 7 used to televise the second half only of a match live. And people started seeing rugby league in all its glory. But once we went to colour television, sponsors came on board, and the sponsors didn't want to see players getting king hit and back play. They wanted to see good, clean rugby league. And that in itself led to the game being cleaned up in the early 80s.
As teams were added to the competition, they were moving out, whether it be Canterbury, St George, that moved out further, then Manly and Parramatta, and then Penrith, Cronulla, and then beyond the borders of Sydney. Has it been an unqualified success, do you think, Ian?
I think it has. I think the game had to evolve and had to go further. The AFL made that decision, and I think the NRL had to go with them. A couple of reasons. You've got to feed the masses, and in this age of enormously high TV broadcast deals across both free-to-air and pay TV, you have to get more reach than the Eastern Seaboard. They need to spread their wings. And for the next broadcast deal coming up, which they're talking $1 billion or some crazy amount, I mean, that's a lot of money, and it has to go to a lot of people, and otherwise the broadcasters just won't pay that money.
And I think the league in decentralising sowed the seeds of its own destruction, especially the old New South Wales Rugby League, because once you brought in privately owned clubs like the Brisbane Broncos, they were going to challenge the status quo. And Brisbane, from the first year, you know, 1988, was always challenging the New South Wales Rugby League to be more equitable in its dealings, wanted a greater share of revenue. And I think that inevitably led to the Super League split in the 90s. I agree with Ian. I don't think the league had any choice. It had to decentralise and go where the people were going. And that's why you find South Sydney fans all over New South Wales and in Queensland, because people have moved from the city over the last 30 years, and rugby league at least has tried to keep pace.
In some ways, the Super League war is still being fought. Did any good come of Super League, do you think?
I think it did. Even though I know there was a war fought against, you know, the historical side against the News Limited coming in and ripping the historical side away, the New South Wales Rugby League were prepared to let sides fall away. And I know in the 70s especially, sides were really struggling, mm-hmm. and this continued on for a decade after that. And they were prepared to let sides fall away. There was a couple of extremely powerful clubs who were basically stockpiling a lot of the players. There was no level playing ground there. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of angst and frustration amongst a lot of clubs. And the clubs were giving an opportunity through News Limited, be it good, bad or indifferent, they were giving an opportunity. And people under stress and when they're struggling, yeah. will grasp at something. And bearing in mind also the pay TV was coming.
Sure.
So obviously from the other side, they were looking at trying to control that through the pay TV market.
Well, I live out in Penrith, and it's the biggest junior league in the world. And I remember in the early 90s when the first news of a Super League being formed came out, and Penrith asked the old ARL, could they guarantee them as a standalone club? And the answer was no. And that's why Penrith went to Super League as well. And, you know, Ian makes a good point, is that, you know, clubs had to shore up their future. And I don't think it was done properly, and I think there was a lot of conflict of interests, but a split was always going to happen once the ARL and the old New South Wales Rugby League showed that they were insular and they weren't going to listen to outsiders to tell them how to run the game. It brought about a lot of changes very, very quickly, and we are still feeling those changes now. But I think it was inevitable that it happened, and some good things did come out of it. But I think the jury's still out on the style of rugby league that we play now, the rule changes that have come, and I'd like to see some consolidation over the next couple of years before we bring in new clubs, right. or expand even further, because we've got to make sure that the product is protected, and I wouldn't want to see too many more changes happening.
Alan Whittaker is one of our guests, is one of the authors of Rugby League Through the Decades, along with Ian Collis. Do you think that rugby league is good at telling its own history, telling its own story, promoting itself?
I've been writing about rugby league for 25 years now, and Ian and I have done a number of books together, and Ian's put together, you know, a fantastic collection that we're able to draw upon when we write together. But, you know, we started off when there were, you know, one or two people writing about the history of rugby league, Gary Lester, Ian Heads, David Middleton, and the league hasn't shown a lot of support in looking after its history, and it's been left to individual writers such as us and the other guys I've mentioned to get out there and to delve into the history and to publish
off our own
backs. Why do you
think
they are
so uninterested?
Well, I think it's like any big organisation. They're worried about the here and the now. They're worried about the bottom dollar. We've always had great support from the league whenever we've published something. You know, they've been very proud of what we've done and very supportive. But it's not as if an organisation like that goes out of its way to organise historical text and interviews. Usually individuals have to do that, and we've been lucky to do it for many years now. We enjoy doing it a lot.
Okay. What about the future then? The Independent Commission is ahead of us. It's been talked about for so long. It was supposed to be in at the end of the year, at the start of the year. Now it might be in at the end of the year. What do you hope to see achieved with an Independent Commission, which is kind of, they're taking the AFL as a kind of model, but not really? What should occur with the Independent Commission, Ian?
Well, obviously, the first thing is to get all the bodies in as one body and try to get them to work together. Yeah. I think in the past they haven't worked together. There's been different reasons why they haven't. There's been different agendas why they haven't. So the first thing is to get everyone working together under one banner. Oh, that's a great start. They then need to look at the overall game. Obviously, the next, like I said earlier, the next broadcast deal is extremely important for the game. That money has to be invested correctly into the game. And if they are going to spread their wings and maybe put a team in Perth, needs to be done in a professional, organised manner, not just a quick grab.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to, the absence of conflict of interest. There's a lot of conflict of interest with a media company owning the game and negotiating it with itself for the future of the game. It's always going to be open up to criticism, even when their intentions are good, to promote the game. I also look forward to the time when rugby league's off the front page of the papers and on the back page of the papers. And I think if the Independent Commission can come in and set up that professional network where the media doesn't have a vested interest in all these bad news stories, then I think that'll be a good thing and the game will be run much more professionally.
Ian, you're the stats man. What have you got for this weekend? Manly against New Zealand? Who will win and why? And what have you got that can tell us some interesting bits of history, perhaps, or something that might happen with the game?
Out-of-town sides in grand finals in Sydney have a very, very good record.
Yeah, they do.
They've had 13 wins and only 5 losses. Out-of-town sides have never lost back-to-back grand finals. The Warriors are coming off a loss. If they lose again, that'll be a first.
Okay, so if a team like the Warriors played in 2002,
yep,
their second time in, they'll probably win.
Stats say they should win.
Oh, dear, I don't like the sounds of that.
Stats are funny things.
Yeah.
Couple of rookie halfbacks, Dale Cherry Evans and Sean Johnson, are first-year rookies.
Yep.
This is the first time in 64 years we've had a grand final with first-year rookies lining up against each other. The last time was 1947 when Des Bryant for the Tigers and Bruce Hopkins for Canterbury lined up against each other.
Wow.
Long time. So I guess that puts in perspective the achievements of both those halfbacks, both Manly and the Warriors, what great years they've had in a pressure situation. The Warriors, in all 3 grand finals this week, take that out, that'll be the first time since 1963 when St George captured all 3 premierships. That has been the case. Brookvale Oval.
Manly with the mighty Manly Sea Eagles.
That's right. They've been undefeated at Brookvale this year. The last previous three years, they were undefeated at Brookie. 1996, 1973, 1972, they won the premiership.
Very good point.
So that's a stat you'd love. One last one, won't bore you too much. Under the McIntyre system, which started in 1999,
yes,
no side outside the top 4 has ever won the premiership. Okay. So the Warriors are going to have to break that stat to get through.
To beat history. But who's going to win, Ian?
I think Manly might just get there. They seem a lot more solid to me. The Warriors definitely have it in them to win, but I think Manly's been the better of the two sides all year. And Manly probably deserve to win it. I think it'll be tight. Whether they do win it or not, time will tell. But I would, if you asked me for a pick, I would say Manly might just get there.
Alan, any interest for you in this grand final?
Oh, absolutely. I getting back to your earlier point, I think Sydney side is, we own the grand final. The grand final's got a great history, and you do have to take sides. But being a Western Sydney boy, and even though I'm married to a Manly supporter, I can't see myself barracking for Manly, even though they're coached by a former schoolmate of mine, Des Hasler.
Really?
I really think New Zealand can win this match. I really feel that maybe it's a little bit of World Cup vibe coming off them. But, they're full of confidence, full of momentum. Those young blokes have never played in a grand final before, so they're going to throw caution to the wind. And don't be surprised if there's not an international team winning the National Rugby League competition this year, which I think will be a first. And I just have this inkling that New Zealand will turn up on the day and cause an upset.
The book you've written is incredible, Rugby League Through the Decades. It's a wonderful book. You know just about everything there is to know about rugby league. What did you find out that you didn't know when you wrote the book? What was something you came across and you thought, boy, I never knew that?
Probably in the beginning, just how tenuous the start of rugby league was.
Right.
It could have folded up in the first couple of weeks, and probably only the tour by the 1908-09 Kangaroos, which came back broke and ruined the career of J.J. Gilton, and who started the competition. But only that impetus gave us a profile outside the country where England were interested in touring in a couple of years' time, so they had something to go on with. But it really did surprise me just how they flew by the seat of their pants in the early years and how it all could have folded up in a couple of years.
I guess from my point of view, it's probably not so much what I learned. It's the pride I have been involved in such a book like that. I mean, just as a young kid growing up around the streets of Ryde, and rugby league was the game I loved, the game I lived and died for.
But there was no book like that when you were growing up. You give it to a boy today, he's going to learn everything about the history of the game, isn't he?
I know. Speaking of half Alan and myself, we're so proud of that book. We feel that book is really... It's got everything. It's got the written word. It's got the vision of what we're about. The historical pieces, photos. I think it's a great piece, and you'd wonderful. Be mad not to have one.
Yeah. Ideal Christmas gift.
It's important, I think, for the current generation of fan, whether you're a Bulldogs fan or a Brisbane fan, to just take a dip in and have a look at how far we've come in the 100 years, because there are a lot of great names, and you know, you may have only heard of Churchill, and you don't see any film of Churchill these days, but at least you can dive into a book like this and read a couple of the newspaper reports that were put in there, or a couple of the photos, and a couple of the eyewitness accounts who played with the great man. And you can build up a picture of, you know, what a great tradition rugby league's had in Australia over the last 100 years.
Should give the book to the players too.
Yeah, I think they've got a huge weight on their shoulders to carry that legacy through into the future. And I think if you see the young players going out to the community and doing charity work, I think they do understand that. Sure, we hear the bad stories, but I think fundamentally they know that the club is an important part of the community, and they know that the foundation clubs have a great history and that they've got to protect that. And if they haven't, then they've got plenty of old players and old coaches and committeemen who can get in their ear and tell them about it.
Alan Whittaker, Ian Collis, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rod. Been a pleasure.
All the best, Rod.
Rugby League Through the Decades. Alan Whittaker and Ian Collis are the authors.